This is gonna hurt. It's time for the Suffering Podcast.
Growing up, we see our parents, as well as other adults, through child's eyes. They are caregivers, they are coaches, and they represent unconditional love. Children put their parents on a pedestal, believing that they were always the way they were in front of us. What most people forget is that there was a life your parents lived that happened before your birth. They have made poor choices, they have made mistakes, and they were normal young people, subject to all the world has to offer. Our parents are able to slip into their respective roles because of the love for their children. What they did in the past has very little bearing on the fact that they want the best life they can provide. The dichotomy of individuals is never so succinctly personified as in those that raised us. I'm Kevin Donaldson here with Mike Felice, and welcome to the Suffering Podcast. If you're a fan of overcoming adversity and overcoming suffering, then we're for you, because that's what we do here and that's the stories we highlight. So do me a favor, hit that like button, subscribe to the channel, please comment, and now you can join. Don't forget to ring the bell so you can get notified of all of our new content, and follow us on social media so you can find out what we're up to. On this episode of the Suffering Podcast, I've been looking so forward to this one.
Long-awaited episode.
I've been looking so forward to this one. I read this whole book just in preparation for you. We welcome Angela Pisano to discuss the suffering of a mob daughter. Angela's father was a dangerous man, but to you, he's just dad.
Yes.
So thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, thank you for having me. And believing in my story.
No, I do. It's a wonderful story. We're going to get into it. Before we go any further, let's give a big shout out to our marquee sponsor. That's Toyota of Hackensack. We don't trust anybody as police, but we do trust them. So go to toyotaofhackensack.com and let them find you a car. So now, Angela, each week we take a question from our audience. This one's coming from Lunella_Sista. I pulled this one for you because I think you're going to have a pretty interesting answer.
I think I know her. I think I went to school with her.
Lunella Sista?
Lunella Sista.
Who is the most dangerous person you've ever met? Angela?
For me, all the people I met through my father were very nice to me. So according to what I hear and a few incidents of what I visibly saw, God rest his soul, would have to be Bobby Kubertz.
Why? What made him so dangerous? Or what, from what you heard?
Well, he was, most of these guys will have a flip that, a switch that will flip. You never knew with him.
We're talking mafia members. We're talking gangsters.
And he went as far as to do this with women in public places. So at the Turtle Brook one night in West Orange, I was in there with girlfriends and some guy friends. He was with an acquaintance friend of mine, dating her, and she didn't do a thing. And it was well across the room, and Bobby Kubertz just flipped. And Jimmy Randazzo was there that night, God rest his soul, also dangerous man, and took him out. And I know Jimmy's parents, and I knew Jimmy, and he said, you know, Ange, you guys got to go, because this could go outside. And Jimmy was also dangerous that way.
You know, dangerous men, that's the problem. Hang around dangerous men. You never know. Yeah. You never know when it's going to go like that.
Yeah.
Mike, what do you think?
You know, I'm going to stay vanilla on this one.
You're gonna have to join the subscription channel to find out exactly what the context of that was, because we had a whole discussion about it.
I'm going to say the most dangerous person in my life was my father. You know, he was the most loving person, you know, and was the greatest father. But if you stepped off, he was going to step off.
So his father, Mike and I will go at each other from time to time. And I remember I've met his father. I've known his father for 20 some odd years.
Before the podcast.
And then after we were doing the show, I go, he tells me his father's coming to an event we were doing. And I said, is he going to punch me?
Right? That's exactly it.
Yeah.
Because with my, like I said, the most loving, the greatest father anybody could ask for. But you knew if you stepped off, he just gave me that look.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he never hit me. Well, you know, never hit me maliciously.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I deserved every hit I got, but he just gave me that look.
And that was it.
You knew you did wrong, and you knew you had to stop doing whatever you were doing.
I was a little afraid of your father, but since he found out I was breaking his son's chops, I'm now his hero.
So. Yeah. When you said, you know, I'm sorry for breaking your son's chops, he goes, you want them, you can have them. Just take them.
But, you know, I grew up, Angela, we've had a lot of discussions about this. I grew up around some really, really dangerous people. And it was never the guys who were perceived as dangerous that I worried about. Because to me, I can see them coming. You know, listen, you're going to break my leg? That'll heal in 6 weeks. You're going to break my fingers? It's a minor inconvenience. You're going to give me a shot in the head? Maybe I'll hear the bang and smell some smoke. Don't care. The most dangerous person I ever met, Mike and I met him together, is a guy named Matt Cox. Matt Cox, who at one time was on the FBI's most wanted list. Now, Matt is a friend of mine, okay? I talk to him not frequently because I keep my distance, but Matt is one of these very odd geniuses in this world who just like to play. That's all they like to do. And he's a small, unassuming guy. There's nothing violent about him. He doesn't have a violent bone in his body. But for fun, he will cripple you financially. He had stolen something in neighborhoods. They don't even know how much he stole from the government, but they think it's upwards of about $50 million through
mortgage frauds.
Yeah, mortgage frauds, identity theft. And he'll tell you he ratted his way down to 12 years because he was getting 25 years.
White collar crime.
Right. Yeah. It's a white collar crime. But he's just one of these guys that likes to figure out the puzzle. Even when he was in prison, he figured out how to make money by writing guys' stories. And he wrote the book War Dogs that went into the movies.
Yeah.
So he just figures stuff out. And then when he got out, he got into the podcasting world and he was on American Greed and all sorts of stuff. But when I walked out of it, and we did his show in his house, I walked out of there and I checked my wallet. I did.
You want to make sure.
And we're friends with some guys who were gangsters or, you know, whatever they were.
We're gangster, crooked cop, and mortgage.
And he's the guy I'm afraid of. That's the weird part because, you know, I guess.
Because he's brilliant.
Yeah.
He really is.
Well, there's different types of fear, right, that we didn't talk about. So when you asked me who's the dangerous guy, interesting. We have two genders right here, right? So from my the vanilla gender.
Vanilla is the word of the day, kids.
So from my aspect of the question or perspective, interestingly, you saw a man like Bobby or Jimmy and people knew. However, you didn't know what they were going to do in a crowd. You didn't know what they were going to do anywhere. And as a woman, believe it or not, women are usually protected by, you know, their boyfriends or their mob husbands. Do they fight? Well, everybody fights.
But that's old school, though. You keep the family out of it.
Right. So from my perspective, that's dangerous to me because I grew up with a father who was immensely disciplined and controlled.
But so, scary.
Yes. So
are women protected by name also? You know what I'm saying? In your situation, growing up the way you grew up, they knew who your father was. So you're kind of protected. You were shielded from
that. Yeah. So with my inside world, we would go into a club down the shore, surf club, Temptations, you know, all the clubs DJs. Back in the day. And someone would say we had the VIP and someone would say something like, do you know, she's Larry Martin's daughter, you know, and in certain circles, the name matters.
Yeah.
And then in other circles, like in New York, if I was in Little Italy or wherever I was in Newark or Belleville, you know, they knew my father was with all the families. He didn't really belong to one family, but he was a Genovese guy for years and years. So that pulled a lot of weight because the Genovese family was about making money, tax-free money, lots of it. They weren't about killing. They would do a sit down any day.
Well, Larry Martin, we're going to get into a lot about Larry Martin, but Lunesta_sister, thank you so much for sending that question in. Keep sending in your questions, and we're going to try to get them on the air.
And I'll see you at our high school reunion.
So you handed me this book. It's a weird kind of introduction to us. I met you through Paul Simmons, who's been on the show. Mm-hmm. Your husband, Joe, works with him. And I remember I get the phone call from Paul. You got this. This is a great story. You got to listen to this story. And gets us in contact. Now, I had to go through a conduit. I had to have a sit down with her husband.
My husband.
He was the maven. And I talked to him and everything. And then I get a call from Angela. And I think the first time we talked, we probably went for about an hour and a half.
Yes.
Yeah. And there's a lot of things that, because I grew up in that area with a lot of those types of people. So I understand the lifestyle behind it. But you grew up in a household with a guy who was invisible, like a true old school invisible mobster. So, yes. You know, what's your earliest childhood memory of something's different about my father? Because kids can tell.
So kids have a sense. I'm a teacher and kids definitely have a sense. So we were, it was 1967, 65, maybe 65. Maybe I was like five. And my mother got up and went to work every day. And my father got up and, you know, was home. Sometimes he would go out in the afternoon, but he was always dressed suit, French cuffs, beautiful clothes. And my mother got vacation, you know, by 67, I was seven. She got vacation. You hear her talking about sick days, you know, there was no PTO, sick days, yeah. Personal time, that kind of thing. And my father never really spoke about, you know, any of that. And so I kind of sensed something was a little different. And we lived in a middle class town. Rutherford was middle class with some affluent areas, but basically middle class. But we had people coming to the house. You know, my father didn't change flat tires. He didn't wash cars unless he felt like it that day. So I knew something wasn't right, like when I went to other houses, because
you're the other parents,
there was always cash around our house.
Your mother wasn't making that much money.
Yeah. Yeah, she actually was, though, yeah. In the eye that yeah. On paper, you know. Yeah.
Which that's actually gets back to the fact that your father is not only smart, but brilliant, because he had a sugar mama.
Yes. Yes. He never owned anything. Yeah. So yeah. Never owned anything, never had a credit card, never.
No. Now your father is, I did my research on trying to look for your father, and your father, Lorenzo Martino, AKA Larry Martin, he's hard to find, which yes. Either means, so there's two ways you can look at it. It's either he wasn't what he says he was, but he didn't say anything, or he was so good, because the good people in the mafia, you never heard about.
No. So everybody that you hear about and you see, they're there for a purpose. They are egotistical.
The glory.
They think they're legitimate. Yep. Paul Castellano, John Gotti. Those are probably, like, Paul Castellano thought he was a legitimate businessman. I don't know what John Gotti thought, but he was the worst of that.
It's called megalomania. You know?
Yeah. Men like Richie Biardo, the Boot, Jip, Ray, Angelo DiCarlo, out of order. These men drove Chevys. They wore
Jip DiCarlo
chinos.
Four Seasons fame.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. So everybody knows the name Jip DiCarlo.
And yes. These guys, they were invisible. And it goes back to even back in the day when at Columbus Circle, you know, Joe Colombo got shot and lived 7 years. And he thought he was a legitimate businessman. He was on the, you know, the TV for the Italian civil rights. And he did this unity thing. And we had to go, my mom and I. But my father was like, he's a boss. And we don't exist.
And I know I read this in a book. You were at Columbus Circle.
Yes.
When Joe Colombo.
Yes, we had to go.
Ended his mafia career.
Yes.
Yes.
So, but back to your original question. So my father, don't forget, started in 1934, maybe, because he started boxing at 15. And that was his gateway to the rackets, and
a lot of them got started in boxing.
Still do. And so he
I always say that's why you never gamble on boxing.
Yeah.
Lots of them were fixed.
Yeah.
So
la 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 la.
Yeah, you gotta know who, right? Yeah. So he that was his gateway. And he is very old school. I mean, he died at 99 in 2014, so he would be over 100. He was not of the modern mentality, which is why lots of the modern management rules of the mafia did not apply to him. And people don't understand that. And why would they? I only did because I lived in this life. It's an organization. And
there's a pecking order.
There's a hierarchy.
Absolutely.
And there's rules. And it's tribal. But he was part of that. He wasn't a Mustache Pete, you know, Sicilian and all of that. But he worked with them. But he was part of that. So you didn't hear of the people from his time too much.
So he and what I read in the book, and we're going to get to the book. It's called Welcome to the Family, which I got a working copy right here so I could prep. I just want to show everybody. It's a really interesting look into the mind of somebody who would have been if he were to go into the legitimate world, mm-hmm. he would have been successful.
Very.
All right. The fact that he didn't go into the legitimate world, he was still successful, but he rose like I read this in here where he only did one prison stint.
Yes.
And that was early on before you were glint in his eye.
The war years.
Yeah. Yeah. People don't understand that it's, you know, you're talking almost 80 years ago now. Yeah. In those times, in order to buy certain goods, you had to get a stamp, a ration stamp.
Yeah.
And, I guess they were very easily counterfeited.
So there, you could buy them online. There were booklets, kind of like the stamps you got at banks back in the day, and you got China, you know. But
to buy chocolate, to buy
like green stamps,
yeah,
and sugar, gas. So everybody wanted gas, and he counterfeited with his partners at the time who were in Chicago. It was around so the war started in 39. We didn't get in World War II till I think 41. So I think it was over in 45. So this must have been around 44, somewhere in there. I know he was working with Willie Moretti at the time and whoever else was involved then, but I wasn't listening too much at 13 years old. And when he was telling the stories. So, yeah, they counterfeit it, and his partners were in Chicago, and he would not fly. But he did because it made him a wealthy man. So he would fly out there, and my mother couldn't warn him. Obviously, there's no cell phones or anything. Got off the plane in Chicago. FBI were waiting. Federal. I mean, this is how people were eating. And they bought the judge off, and they did not do too much time. And as his phrase, it was prison. Prison was wide open. We were okay. It was good.
Right. You're not doing the hard time.
You're not doing hard time. You're making the gravy.
They take care of themselves.
Yeah. So, but my father had a moral side, I think, because he would say, the kids, they were hungry. St. Lucie's, the kids were hungry. He said, so the first place I went was Father Junta. And I said, here, go feed the kids, Father. And he took the books and he knew who Larry Martin was, but he went and he fed those kids. I'm not making excuses.
Sometimes you got to bend the rules to do what's right. And that's the truth. Even as police officers, there are certain times throughout our career where there's the letter of the law, but it doesn't mean that it's 100% correct. For instance, I'll give you a perfect for instance. How many times did you catch a 16-year-old kid with a little bit of with a little joint?
Yeah.
Okay. So if you were to bring that kid in, there is serious consequences to arresting a kid for a little joint, something that all of us have probably done throughout our lives. So you stomp it out and you give them a warning. And hopefully that's enough to scare them a little straight. So what's right is not always right. So
Well, you're talking the gray area. Right?
I always said there was a fine line between good and bad. But the line is straight. But the gray area kind of serpentines around the line. Yeah. You could be on both sides of that line and still be doing the right thing.
And in my father's business, and again, I'm not making excuses for his life. He chose it. And I'm not saying that what he did was correct, but he was not an enforcer. He was not a hitman. He was not muscle. He was extremely smart. So the mafia uses sociopaths and psychopaths for cutting up bodies. Yeah. There is
the strong arm stuff.
There is no doubt there is severe violence and torture going on. However, you signed up for that because it's a tribal.
Well, everybody has
a role. Tribal hierarchy, and you live by tribal rules. But he was a businessman.
Every organization, whether it's legitimate or illegitimate, mm-hmm. has roles that are assigned.
Exactly.
This person packages the good. This person mm-hmm. does the accounting. And this person does, you know, some people do the grunt work. Some people got to dig ditches. Right. Other people get to work with the money.
Right.
The mob is no different. And that's something that people got to understand.
Well, I think what people don't understand, though, is it's truly in business to make money, tax-free money.
Yeah.
So they put people where they belong. And then you have a choice, too. More in my father's day, you have a choice. But my father was smart. A quick story. So he always had tailored clothes, my mom and dad. And his tailor, not his first tailor, but his other tailor was in Lyndhurst on Kingsland Avenue. And his name was Carlo. And Carlo was a huge gambler in the 70s.
Fantastic story in the book about this.
Huge, huge gambler. Not, my father was not he loan sharked, but he did, that was not what he did. And Carlo was not doing this with my father. He was from Italy. They would go to the clubs. And his loan shark was probably a guy from Italy. So my father was waiting for his camel hair coat. And it wasn't done. And Carlo, Larry, you know, it'll be done. And my father got mad and very controlled. Angela, let's go. We're going down Newark for pastries. And we're going to stop and see Carlo. So we went in and his mother was always sitting in the shop on a, you know, dining room chair. And my father would always go over to hers. And I didn't speak Italian, but my father did fluently, many dialects. And he said, Signora, you know, and he was talking to her. And then he went over to Carlo and he, where's my coat? And Carlo said, it's not ready. And, you know, so I didn't notice anything. So he said a few words to Carlo in Italian. I understood some of the curse words. Stroons, you know, different things. So fungal. So we leave. We get in the car and we leave. And my father looks at me and we're going down Newark now to Catherine's Bakery. And he says to me, so I took a razor and I sliced up all his textiles. And I said, what did you do that for? And he said, Angela, he said, I've been with this guy over 7 years. I pay him in cash. I tip him. He said, treat him well. He said, and you make me wait. He said, and what am I going to do? I can't break his legs and I can't break his arms. He said, but I could hit him in the pocket. You want to, you know, screw with me? Can't make money now. Go buy all new textiles. And I learned that day. It was actually a pretty good way to handle things. His coat was ready. His mother got her $100 bill when we went back. And she was always like, Lorenzo, hugging him, you know. And then when we walked out, he said to Carlo, you touch that money, you know, and he was cursing at Carlo, you know, you'll take it from your mother, that kind of thing. You know, when I'm not cursing, but he was cursing at Carlo. And Carlo was nervous. And everything was always on time. Matter of fact, about a week early. So,
your father is such an interesting character from his early days. But what I love the most is how he met your mother.
Yes.
I mean, this is the swagger on this guy.
Yeah.
That he must have been, his confidence level, which is always the most attractive to women, must have been through the roof. Because I want you to tell everybody a little bit how your mother and father met.
It's a short little story. So my dad was already established in the rackets, and I didn't know him, obviously, in the 40s, but he had a lot of charisma, tailored suits, and all of that. And he was to be married that Saturday. This was like a Tuesday or a Wednesday to his childhood sweetheart, Anna. And my mother and my Aunt Vi were walking down Bloomfield Avenue, and you know, Bloomfield Avenue was like Main Street, USA,
yeah, exactly.
And all the shops and everything.
It was safe back then.
Yes, it was safe. And so my father was coming out of one of the clubs, and my aunt and my mom were just walking by at that time, and he kind of bumped right into them, and he bluntly said to my mother, hi, you know, how are you girls doing or whatever? And then he said, I'm getting married Saturday and I can't get out of it. But when I get back, I'm going to give you a call. Could I have your number? And my mom, and there were party lines then. And, you know, my grandpa was an immigrant. So they did have a phone, but I don't know how many were on party lines, you know. And so my mother gave the number. My Aunt Vi, the more conservative, couldn't believe it, as I've heard this story over the years. And he couldn't wait. He called from his first, from his honeymoon with Anna in Virginia Beach, my mom. And they spoke on the phone. And when he came home, they started their 14-year affair. Wow. My mother was 20 and 44, and my father was almost 30.
The swagger on somebody to do that, and you're for another.
Or speaking Italian, the cojones.
And for your mother to accept the dynamic is a very interesting thing, too. So it speaks to how magnetizing his personality must have been.
It speaks to also how I think my mother was not your typical. So I'm more traditional than my mom. And she was born in 1924. So she was a rebel.
I love it how when the older generation says, oh, you kids, I never did anything. Bullshit.
They did everything.
They did everything.
No, my mother liked what she saw. I said to my aunt.
So she just wasn't window shopping for clothes.
No. Yeah, she was. She liked the suit he was wearing.
Yes. And Barney Googles, Barney Zarrow, famous Barney Googles pizzeria in the North Ward, not too far away from the Belmont, back in the day. And God rest Barney's soul. We had dinner at the Belmont maybe 3 or 4 years before he
Chicken
passed.
Chicken Savoy.
Chicken Savoy, beeps, you know, the usual. You know, and you get yelled at by the waiters if you ask for something.
I was actually asked to go to get Chicken Savoy tonight.
The vinegar
at the Belmont. Yeah, the my vinegar. Friends went over there and I'm like, I can't go, I got the podcast.
we could have did it there.
So. Yeah, we could have did it live from the Belmont.
There you go.
So yeah, so Barney, he was 92 and we're at the Belmont and I'm sitting next to him with other people. And he says to me, I guess this was around 2016. And he says, your mother was so goddamn gorgeous. He said, and only a guy like Larry could get her. He said, but she was so conceited. Me, she wouldn't look at me. She thought, pizza, you're coming home with flour. So my mother knew she was very pretty.
So your mother and father have this 14-year, let's call it what it is. It's an affair.
It's an affair.
Was there any, obviously your mother knew about your father's first wife. Did the first wife know about her?
Oh, yes.
And it's perfectly acceptable.
No.
I don't.
So let's get that
it's
straight.
It's so foreign to the way.
No.
Did you ever watch The Sopranos?
I did, but they're all
Carmela
hidden.
And Tony. So my father, he saw a beautiful woman, you know, and he went on his honeymoon, called my mom, came home with Anna. They moved into their home in Newark, and he was doing quite well. He was probably doing he was doing the counterfeiting, and he was buying up houses. He had owned about 7 houses. I'm assuming they were in Anna's name. And he had a big tattoo, even at 99 on his deathbed, Anna, you know, at the Sailor Girl. And my mother didn't care. She did not care. She liked what she saw. My father had money, so they were not going to the neighborhood restaurant. They were going to the Copa. They were going to the Stork Club. They were the Vesuvius in Newark was not owned by Lenny Ristano at the time. It was owned by Don DiDonna. And it was a major place, and they were going to all these major places. But beyond that, they were just love struck. I really think they were just love struck. They were practically the same person, and they carried on their 14-year affair. Did Anna confront her? Yes. Did Anna throw out my father? Yes. And he would go to my Aunt Jenny's, his sister's, and Uncle Emil, you know, go back home in a few days. But he carried on.
This is not your normal Gumad situation. This is
no.
This is this is somebody, if you're staying with somebody for 14 years, there's well beyond it.
There's got to be feelings there.
No, yeah. And my mom, so of course you don't discuss everything with your children, and nor should you. And I'm a teacher, so don't. So I'm telling you that. So I did say to my mom one day, when I was like 18, I said, what did you do for 14 years? And she said, you have to understand, Daddy and I were together a lot. She said, I concentrated on us. It had nothing to do with Anna. So she compartmentalized. On top of that, she said to me, and one year I just got very annoyed with him because we were doing our Christmas Eve at 10:30 like we usually do, because he was with his family, my aunts and uncles, and Anna Curcio's family, you know, doing the family thing, right? And my mother said, well, I'm not going to wait till 10:30 this year. So to go to the Vesuvius or the Red Devil. So she asked my aunt, Millie, sister-in-law, Uncle T, my uncle's wife, and they had, again, no children yet, but they were married. She said, let's go to Florida. They got on a train. They went to Florida. They went to Miami. They stayed at the Fountain Blue or one of the hotels like the Fountain Blue. I can't remember if she said the Fountain Blue or not. She said, but it was very, you know, elite. And that's what they did. And she said to my father, I'm going to Miami. You know, you want to pick me up at 10:30? And Millie and her went, my aunt. So I'm sure there were fireworks.
she had some rebellion. She had some rebellion in her.
My mom was very rebellious for the day. And I think even for now, I would not approve of my daughter going out with a married man in the mafia to boot.
Yeah.
Eventually, obviously, that marriage ends and your parents stay together.
Yes.
Which I'm hoping you're the product of. And you get born into this lifestyle that you couldn't possibly fathom at a young age.
I didn't ask for it.
You didn't ask for it. You didn't ask to be born. Nobody does. And you just think that this is the way that it is. When was the first time that you have a conscious memory of, okay, something's...
Your family's different from other families.
My family's different. It's kind of going back to where we went. Where
so
we
you
ended
asked
up.
Me that. So yeah. I kind of gathered it. I would go to other houses. You know, Rutherford was a walking town. Yep. You know, you ride your bike to your next door neighbor, right? So I would go in their house at 5 in kindergarten.
But you saw things that you had to keep to yourself, and that's kind of where I was going.
But I'm saying, so I was like, oh, there's cash all over my house, you know, and the way my parents, like, they used to deliver drugs and liquor back in the day from the pharmacy in Lyndhurst. I think it was People's Pharmacy. Mr. Lavaghetta, you know, was the back in the day.
Does everybody over there have a vowel at the end of their name?
Back then they did. Yeah.
So I was internalizing it, but I didn't say, because this was my norm. But in 1965 or 1966, whenever I started kindergarten, it was an ordinary morning, and the door, there was a big thud, and FBI men came and they knocked the door in, and they had warrants, and I don't know if they had a subpoena, but they had warrants. And my mother was not one to play nice or ask for coffee or any of that. She was in her bra and her girdle and pulling up her stockings, and they had come in, and she threw something on, and I remember my dog Cindy barking at them and going for their ankles, terrier, and
fear, chaos.
Yeah, and I was crying, and I was scared, and I was, you know, I was 5, so I didn't know what was going on, and there was 3 of them, and 2 were searching, and 1 was making the way back to the bedroom. And my father was on the end of the bed, walking down, had his robe on, and said, you know, let my wife put on her house coat, and take care of my daughter, bring her to the kitchen. Okay. So 1 was already sitting at the kitchen table. So I didn't know what they were doing. We got back to the kitchen. All of the cabinet doors were open. Things were on the floor. My mother didn't say 1 word.
I'm sure your mother was prepped for this day.
Oh, yeah.
Well, she was prepped from when she met my father. Right. So.
Well, your father probably had that conversation. Listen, if this happens, this is how you act.
So my mother was a rebel, but she was also a dichotomy. Don't forget, because she was complicit.
I used that term in my opening, and you think it's
what term?
Dichotomy.
Dichotomy.
Oh. And they had to look it up.
So She was complicit too. And she also was, you know, marriages, I've got your back.
Well, the, right? Yeah.
So she had his back. So she knew his contact book was.
In today's terms, she would have been arrested under RICO.
Yeah. So there was no RICO yet.
RICO was 74?
70 or 72, because my father was indicted again in 69.
That was the one I read where he was indicted with Jip DiCarlo.
Yeah, they were all indicted for interstate gambling and all of that. But so that morning, so that was my introduction. So my father kept a little black book with all the contacts in the sugar bowl or by the sugar bowl. And my mother just, you know, went over, poured a cup of coffee, put it in her girdle. I didn't know what was going on. The dog's barking. They're tearing the house apart. My father's in the bathroom, of course, you know, doing his French cuffs and putting on his cologne and taking a shower.
He's not even fazed.
He's oblivious to it all.
And he comes out and my mom says, when he comes out, my mom says to the guys, I'm taking my daughter to school, so I need to take her to the bathroom and clean her up. You could show yourself out. And my father says, well, I have to go down and work with them. And I remember my father looking at me and he said, I'll be back this afternoon. I have to go down Newark. And because he knew I knew Newark, you know, with these nice men. These are my friends. And I'm thinking, friends?
They just ruined the
and
house.
And I'm crying, you know? And so they, and he says, I'll see you later. We'll go to Lyndhurst Park, my favorite park. So my mother says to me, come on, let's go in the bathroom. I put on my little jumper, did my hair, wash my face. We get in the car, we go to Sylvan Street. I was only there for 1 year. That's where the kindergarten children went. And then they went to their other schools.
Sylvan School.
Yeah. So in Rutherford. So she says to me, it was a busy morning. And I said on the way, I couldn't articulate it, but I knew this wasn't right. And I said to her on the way to school, who were those men? I knew they weren't friends. And she says, oh, she said, they had the wrong house, Angela. Daddy had to go down Newark to explain it.
Mm.
And then we got in and she said to the principal and to my teacher, we had a very, very busy morning. So Angela's a little late, but, you know, she's fine. She's had breakfast and everything. And that was it. And I think, as I recall, that's probably when my knots started in my stomach, because I knew something was wrong.
Like I said, kids have I said it earlier.
Second sense.
Kids know when an important person walks in the room. They just know it. You don't have to tell them. And you knew, just like you knew, this wasn't right. Mm-hmm. And it affected you internally. And it's one of the downsides. As much as your father was, and I've read a lot about your father in here, he was a doting father. He was very, you know, it's counterintuitive to what most people who we know think about the mafia lifestyle. These are, I grew up with these guys. So they're fathers, they're coaches, they're everything. And they're also some bad men sometimes, but they have families. They care for their children just like everybody else.
Right. So they're not. So I want to make this clear. In the mafia, there are psychopaths and sociopaths. My father used to say to me when I was about 14, every single day, if I smile the wrong way, if I'm in a room with a sociopath, I could die. So he had that human nature thing down, but that was the minority. And if you were an enforcer, didn't mean you were a sociopath, and it didn't mean you were a psychopath. It meant you were to kill because you were ordered and you accepted that position and people signed up.
One of the best
examples killed.
One of the best examples I've heard from the book that your father was friendly with was Lefty Two Guns Ruggiero.
Yes. Who killed.
Who killed. But from
everything. And I loved him.
Isn't that something?
Thank God. Else?
Well, you compartmentalize. You have to understand these men separate that. And these men, like Lefty, he was not a psychopath or a sociopath. He was old school mafia, maybe 2 or 3 years older than my father. And that's why I keep saying it's a tribal mentality. When you sign up for this, it's tribal. You don't cross the family. You do your job. You have to learn to speak a certain way. You have to learn to talk a certain way. Most people that want to go up the ladder will start as not a capo's driver. Capos don't really have drivers. but an underboss, a street boss, a front boss, driver. They open the door for you, that kind of thing. And you may not know to do that. You better know who you're reporting to.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's tribal. Lefty was an enforcer at one point, but he was not a psychopath or a sociopath.
See, I say all the time, like any business, and even the mafia, which is really a business.
That's what I said. Yeah.
It's like a body. Every part has its, you know, has its thing to do. You know, mm-hmm. It has its job. It has its purpose. Mm-hmm. It's the same way any business is. Same way the mafia is. You know, you got the brains, then you got the arms, mm-hmm. you know, and then you got everything mm-hmm. else.
So to put this into context with everybody, what you just said was so very important, because I'd heard this was described to me this way. The downfall of the modern Italian mafia
today
has a lot to do with nepotism. Bosses are putting their kids in high-level positions that they didn't earn. To put it in our world, so in police departments, they will have other cops transfer, family members, friends, whatever, nepotism. It's 100% nepotism. And they'll come in there, and they'll come in at high salaries, and what it does to the lower rank and file is it kills morale.
Yeah.
And it killed morale in the mafia. John Gotti, I heard this about John Gotti. He puts Junior into a high-level position, which he didn't earn. He didn't work his way up. He didn't learn the etiquette that you were just talking about. Mm-hmm. And what happens to the rank and file? Well, screw him. He didn't earn anything, so I'm just going to dime him out. I'm going to rat him out. Mm-hmm. And that's what they did. Mm-hmm. So that puts it in context. Just think of whatever you're doing in your current life, and somebody gets a job they don't deserve, you're going to resent them.
So Carmine Persico he had his brother, Allie Boy, but then his son, Allie Jr., and then there was Theodore, and, you know. So the Persicos, Carmine was, to some extent, guilty of that. And
well, he was also guilty of hiring Greg Scarpa.
Yes. and my father knew Carmine from way back when my father's story. We used to hijack milk trucks. What were we getting? Milk and eggs. And I said, Dad, why are you hijacking? He goes, my brothers and sisters needed to eat. Mm. So I'm not condoning it. But my father had no patience for legitimate work. Because
I think your father
wasn't lucrative enough.
I honestly think your father wasn't fit to be a worker bee.
No. And he didn't have the patience. And like he said, there was no money for college. There was no community college. Yeah. You know who went to college? Wealthy families. So, but Carmine Persico was guilty of that today. Yes, families are guilty of it. And many years ago, as I'm thinking back, lots of men I knew that were in the business, their parents were home crying that their sons got into the rackets by running numbers at 14. Because, yep. You know, they'll so at these social clubs, at least in Newark and even in Little Italy, kids will run numbers, you know, Gigante held court on Sullivan Street. And then they're watching, right? And some are more prone to this.
Well, you see that in A Bronx Tale.
So, exactly. So lots of the parents, they didn't want this. They wanted their child in a factory job. There was no money.
Well, that's another common misperception. You grew up if you grew up in an Italian neighborhood, most families did not want that life for their children.
No.
The vast majority. Unfortunately, sometimes people get taken by the streets. But you've had some run-ins. You've had, aside from the FBI breaking down your front door when you were five, did you ever feel in danger? Because I don't know how much you knew growing up in the teenage years when you became really self-aware of your surroundings. Mm-hmm. Did you ever feel in danger at all?
With these men?
With anybody, you know, whatever the lifestyle is.
No.
Never. That's interesting. Do you think?
And I sat down with Jamo, who was an enforcer in the 30s, and then he went all the way to Capo, and I, you know, Lefty Ruggiero and Matty Iannello, and loved Mike Sabella, loved Matty, loved Mike Sabella, loved Lefty, Sam DiCavalcanti.
Of the fame. Well, yeah. That's the Sopranos. Yeah. For everybody, that's the Sopranos. Was.
So did I ever feel danger? Did I ever feel personally in danger? No.
That's insane, because the level of your father, especially not being a tough guy enforcer. I'm sure your father was tough. Let me rephrase that. Let me rephrase that. He wasn't an enforcer. They must have had some respect for him. Either that or he was a hell of an earner.
So growing up, if you were to ask me right now, one word that your father taught you, and he taught me many lessons. He taught me to produce. He was a producer. He was an earner. And he used to say, Angela, you have to produce.
You hear that, Andrew? You have to produce. You
have to produce.
Was there any kind of, I don't want to say fear, but like when your father went out at night, you knew the life he was living. And that's what we were saying. That's why parents didn't want their kids to get into it.
I didn't like cops.
What are you doing?
I've heard this before. And
I don't like, do I like cops now? So cops have to do their job. And I respect police officers. Do I like cops personally? Because I do compartmentalize. No, I don't like what they did. I don't like how they treated me, including FBI. Like they going into high school, driving my car, they're sitting in a drab sedan. They're not supposed to talk to me. And they're looking at me. And this is my high school. And I'm 17. And I was made aware. These are not insurance men. And one morning, somebody says to me, morning, Angela. I told my parents as soon as I just swung my pocketbook was swinging and looked at these idiots. And I went to school, waited till I got home, told my father. He called his attorney that he kept on retainer, said, Jerry, she's 17. You got to go down to work. They can't be talking to her. And if you're a cop, do your job. You don't say good morning to a 17-year-old going into school.
Their innocence in all of this, and truly are. You at 17, you had no, I'm sure your father really shielded you from that life.
But your question to me was when I was older and aware, like, did I feel, so I didn't feel in danger with any of these men. Even if I was sitting at the bar at, you know, Casa Polizzi, sitting with Jamo, I'm not going to name names, but there were some men that worked out of the Belmont that were psychopaths and that were sociopaths. And if I saw them there, unlike Larry Day or other people, and not that I went in, but if I had friends I saw in there, I would park and run in. And then my father would say to me all the time, you can go in the Belmont. I catch you at the finish line. Because the finish line was a place in Newark that the racket guys with morals didn't like the finish line guys. So, you know, that even has a hierarchy. So, no, I never felt endangered.
One of the things that we've spoken about, because Mike and I have experienced this firsthand, when criminals retire or, you know, they get out of prison and they reform, and retired police, there is a common bond there. People don't think that there's a capability where we could be friendly with each other or even friends. But most good cops that I know, they could have gone the other way so easily. They just chose that path, and then half of their friends chose the other path. That's how it was. That's how I grew up. Like some of my friends were criminals. I went the other direction. There's a lot of common traits between a real criminal and a cop. Type A personalities, likes adventure, likes the adrenaline, likes a certain lifestyle. So there's a lot of commonalities. So we're working on you changing that mindset where you don't like cops.
You're right, though, but you're lacking the money.
Well, right? You got no, right. New Jersey. No, New Jersey, that's changed. That's changed.
Well, nobody gets into law enforcement to be a millionaire, though.
Like teaching. Yeah. But and you brought something up interesting. So most people in the rackets do not retire wealthy. Let's be clear about that.
No, you end up in jail or dead.
It's the dons that end up with money, or they don't, because the lawyers will run through it. It's because you like the life. Yeah. It's a life. And I left that life just like that. Do I remember that life? Did I like it? Yeah. What was not to like? And
getting catered to and protected.
And that's something you just brought up. I was protected. And
because you had a loving father who happened to be a gangster.
That's exactly how I, yes. So why can't you be a good husband and a loving father and a coach and a good man in the community and be in the mafia? Why can't you do both?
Because Goodfellas says it doesn't happen. I'm dead serious. Goodfellas says it doesn't happen. However, you have a movie like The Godfather, where Don Corleone and his wife, there's no chicanery going on. There's no kumad on the side. There's no but it's him and his wife. That's the and she. So when I read this book, that's what came to my mind. She protected him. She knew what he was.
My mother was his kumad. Let's be clear about that.
In the beginning.
But
I'm talking afterwards.
Yes, but she also at some point realized, right, this was more than that. So that's why she stuck out the 14 years.
Now you're,
but you know, I mean, just getting back to your father real quick. I'm sure he was well respected in town because I'm sure he. Yeah. Hey, how you doing? You know.
Well, everybody got tipped.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And like in Rutherford back in the day, around 2-3 in the morning, woke me up every time we had garbage night. Somebody came around and took our garbage cans out to the sidewalk. So everybody got tipped.
And I'm sure the politicians were very nice to the family.
Yes. Yes.
Exactly.
He went to all the Rutherford Labor Day festivals, you know.
The true gangsters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And So
exactly.
But he was not pretentious. He was very humble. He, I could remember my father telling me, I may wear clothes like this, and so does mommy, and you do too, but you only wear one pair of shoes at a time, and that's all you need.
Yeah.
So I wasn't raised with excess.
Now, your father had a very unique opportunity to actually leave and somewhat retire?
Yeah.
But there was a reason why, and there's a major event that a major movie was made out of, which sort of told him, okay, it might be time to head out.
Oh, yes. So I guess I was like 16 years old, and we had just gotten back from Mexico, Acapulco, my mom, myself, and my cousin. And my father had started talking about, I guess around that time, that's how I remember, things are getting tight, not crazy about who's coming up. The bosses are getting lax. Things were changing, right? So he kept talking about it. And then I remember my mother saying, what are you talking about? And he said, you know, Lefty, I got to go over for these sit downs with him because he's gambling 120 G's. And there's a sit down and he pays it, starts again. He says, but he's with this guy, Donnie. And he said, he's got a mustache. It's like the Yankees. You can't have any facial hair. So he had a mustache. Like
the Yankees.
Yeah.
The Yankees.
Also criminals. Also criminals.
They steal your Christmas presents.
They've stolen so many World Series trophies.
He just did not like this guy. And my father was not involved in going to Florida. He was asked many times to go to Hallandale, to go to Miami, where all the Southern contingency was.
To see Santo Traficante.
Yes, and Sonny Black, Nalpatano, who, when Mike Sabella got demoted after Carmine Galante got gunned down, they demoted Mike Sabella from Cabo to, I guess, back to soldier, and Sonny took the crew. And, you know, my father just, he would go to Brooklyn a lot in Staten Island. He did not like this guy. And he said, I got to start pulling out. Let's be clear. You don't get a pension. You don't get anything. And sometimes you don't get to retire. But my father was from an era where, as Tommy DeVito told me when I spoke with him, he didn't belong to any one person or any one group. He worked for anybody he wanted. He started a long time ago. He proved himself, and he was smart, and he made money. So he really was from an old school rule book.
But he's also a unicorn in the mafia, as modern way thinks, because he's able to navigate in and out of different
all
families.
All five?
Yes. Yeah. And he was mostly with the Genovese, the Bananos, So, but anyway, so things were getting tight. He start going, as he said, he start going over less and less. Now, when you would go to Mulberry Street, the social clubs, also the Motion Lounge, and there were social clubs in Brooklyn and Harlem and Staten Island. But when you would go to Mulberry Street, I remember my father saying to my mother, what the hell are they doing? They're walking up and down that block talking. He's like, this guy. He's like, they got to go down the side streets. They got to all be tapped the payphones. So, and sure enough, it came out in the book they were.
Mm-hmm. There's pictures of those guys walking up and down that Mulberry Street.
Yeah, I walked with them sometimes. I remember, you know, Joe Pistone. And my father didn't buy that he was a jewel thief. He just didn't buy that whole story.
That's intuition.
So he start pulling away. And by 81, he was out. And that's Lefty got picked up in 81, I believe, in August. Sonny Black, you know, got killed.
Which Sonny Black actually got it the worst because he got his hands cut off because he brought somebody in that was impure.
And yeah.
They found him a year later in the river in a bag.
Yeah. Well, Lefty brought him in, but it was Sonny's responsibility. See, when you head a crew, it falls on you.
Anthony Mira also got killed.
Anthony Mira got killed, yeah. Too. And I think Sonny was only 53. But he knew. And Lefty did not go to jail, like they said. But he did die not too long after. I think he had some form of cancer.
He had...
and maybe emphysema.
He had cancer. Smoker. He had cancer, but I think it was... they say it in the movie. I can't even say. He had genital cancer.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's what it was. And he got out in, I think he died in 96, but he was only out for like 6 months.
You don't have to worry about genital cancer.
No, I do not. No, I do not.
So, and it is true about these guys. Somebody asked me this, so I'm just going to say it. These guys, I don't know if it was in a movie. I don't know. But somebody said to me, what's with the draft? I said, oh, my father was the same way. I said, because he smoked Lucky Strikes, but not a whole pack, maybe five a day.
Oh, with the window down.
And my father always had that window cracked. And my mother going to the city on a Saturday night, what the hell are you doing? I'm ruining my French twist, you know. And he said, well, I don't want the draft. I'm just keeping it open for a few minutes before we get to the tunnel. I've got to put the windows up. And I remember Lefty always with they didn't want the draft. That goes back to Italy. If you go to Italy now and it's a hot day and you sit in a restaurant under, if that's the air condition, they will tell you, you have to ask to sit there. They will not seat you there because you could get pleurisy. You could get bronchitis. Yeah. So that goes back. So all those guys, I don't know who the hell asked me, a friend. I said, oh, it was all true. So they could open the doors and the smoke would pour out because they would not open a window.
So. You have this wonderful book, which you were so kind to let me read, Welcome to the Family, which is not the original title, but it's the original title was actually kind of cool. And you get into it in there. It's called They're at the Chinese Restaurant, which is right under here. And that was the term for when they were locked up.
Yeah. But,
this is a really interesting book. It's a page turner because we've touched on some of the stories here, but there's so many more in here that are riveting. Why write a book about your father, this invisible man who obviously wanted to be invisible? To stay invisible. Why write a book about him and all these exploits? He was a successful gangster, which isn't newsworthy.
And he was a soldier if he was slotted, because he really wasn't slotted, but if you had to slot him. So he was not high up. He reported to captain. But why did I write it? Interesting reason, I think. And I'm going to say first, my father is looking down saying, Angela, you're with cops. Come on. So, are you kidding me?
Respect.
So tell me where the money's buried.
So this is how I wrote the book. I woke up one day and I said, I think I'm going to sit down and write a book. And I told my husband and he says, nobody does that. I said, well, I do that. And I sat down and I hand wrote and I just start writing. And I thought about why I felt I needed to write this book. And I needed to write it for two reasons. I think it's a story that's worth telling. I think that it's a story of not only, I don't even want to say surviving for me, for my father, This is how he survived the Depression. Seven children, a mother that died when he was 15.
It really
this
humanizes.
Was his way of surviving, for right or wrong. He made his choices and he lived with them. For me, it's worth telling because I worked with children for 22 years as a teacher. And one day, Sean Brown says to me, "I didn't do my report, Mrs. Pisano." And I, big chunky kid, you know, one of those jolly guys, sixth grade. I said, "Why?" He goes, "My dad." He said, "You know, he's a bookmaker at Barnes and Nobles, and he's up all night making the books, the bindings." Now, innocent sixth grade. They're usually not this innocent. And Sean probably knew, but he didn't want to
elaborate.
So I said, "Okay, you know, do it when you can." Of course, his father was a bookmaker, but he was not making books. And I have a feeling that things did not go right that morning in his household.
You would have been there, done that moment.
So I'm not saying it made me a better teacher. What I'm saying is I think my lifestyle gave me a lot of insight and perspective and intuition that maybe somebody else wouldn't have because it was from such a young age. So it was a story worth telling for me because this is a story where you don't just survive, you thrive. You thrive. I had a legal mom. I had an illegal dad. I went to college. I worked in high school a little bit because I had to beg my father. He didn't want me to work. I wanted to work just a little bit. I left a life. I was told education, education, education. Stay away from this life. My father used to say it all the time. This is not a clean life. This is a disgusting life. And I'm not saying that my life is wonderful, but I left it behind. I taught school. I live in a nice suburban town, raised two children with Joe. And
Joe's a guy we got to get in here. What's it like marrying a mobster's daughter?
I made him ask father to go to Fort Lauderdale with him, and we were going to sleep in separate hotel rooms, and he didn't know he was a retired mafioso. Then I told him in Florida.
See, you know, and that's a question I was going to ask you before. What was dating like in your teens? Because nobody wanted to come around you.
So dating for me, I think, was, first of all, the guys didn't know why my father wore the uniform of a sport coat, dress pants, and a nice shirt sitting on the couch watching boxing. And my father was a man of basically no words. So he, you know, he would say hi, but he was cordial, but no words. So I think guys were a little, you know, a little leery.
They should be.
And one of my high school boyfriends, I guess he was a senior, I was a sophomore or something. And he was leaving out of the side door. And my father, always about 10 o'clock at night, would make demitasse and his feuilletels before he'd go to work. His favorite pastry. And so my boyfriend kissed me, and he only kissed me on the cheek real quick. And my father walked in at that point, and I think he was going to hit the floor. I thought, and my father just looked at him, and he said, "You kissing your sweetheart goodnight? See ya." It was like, okay, see ya. And he liked them, but I think they were a little leery. And I think,
But I think we need to bring Joe in here, Mike.
Yeah,
think we need to bring Angela's husband in.
Yeah, so when we got off the plane,
let's not tell Angela though. Yeah.
When we got off the plane though, and came home, and we were engaged with no ring or anything. But then I told him in Florida, so he had no clue, you know, that he was selling this story. And of course, my father was so smart. He's like, "You think it's okay for you to go? You go, you know." And
give him enough rope to hang himself.
That's what my father used to say. If a person that wants rope and he needs a little more, just keep giving it to him. So, yeah. So
before when's the book coming out? Let's start there. When's the book coming out?
I think probably January.
January.
Yeah. That's okay. The projected date.
And it's going to be everywhere, of course. And this, from reading this is, it's not going to end in text, in my opinion. It's going to go further than text.
I think so.
I do, because what this does is it humanizes a life that they've demonized a lot. You know,
By no means, though, are these men.
But they humanized.
I humanized him.
Yes.
But by no means is this a life you want to aspire to.
No. It does not glamorize the life in any way. All it does is talk about it's like a father-daughter story with mm-hmm. a backdrop in the world of the mob. And it's fascinating. Mm-hmm. And when you told me about it, I'm like, you said, do you want to read it? Of course I want to read it. This is wonderful. So I'm looking forward to this coming out. Now, there are other women in your shoes that you were in, where their fathers are not nice people. Doesn't have to be the Italian mafia, in all different walks of life. So if you were to talk to somebody like little Angela, who was running around the house, who didn't really know any well, knowing what you know now, what advice do you think you would give them?
So the advice I would give to children, so we didn't talk about this, but I used to get knots in my stomach. I couldn't eat. And our doctor would say Coke syrup. There was always Coke syrup. Yeah. The medicine, you got at the pharmacy for my stomach. And there was anxiety. And I was at attorney's house, going over indictments and the grand jury and the trial, right? So a kid worries about that because I lived with the anxiety of, yeah, I'm doing well here, right? I have a nice life. It's joyful, all of that. But in a second, it could change. And my advice to little children today is the same thing that I got from Bobby Gelnella, who was our doctor and friend after my father's first cousin. I was like 16 or 17 sitting in his office on Newark Avenue. And he said, Angela, I was still having stomach issues, Coke syrup, knots in my stomach. And he said, your parents are smart. They will always protect you. They will, keep you shielded. Let them do the worry. So the only advice I could give kids is don't worry. Don't worry about this. You be a kid. You play. Go out for that football. Go out for the cheerleading, the lacrosse. Go play music. Get on the bike. And let your parents really stay in the adult world. And that's the only advice. The other thing is that for children, if this is your normal and it's a safe place, then that's your normal. Don't let anybody tell you ever that's not your normal.
Normal's a dual-edged sword.
Yeah, this was my normal.
What's normal to you might not be normal to me and vice versa.
Yeah.
So, Angela, we're coming to the end of this. I know it goes fast. It goes fast. And I wish we had time to tell more because I know there's a lot more here.
Andrew charges us too much for the studio.
Yeah.
So we can't stay too long now.
So I know what on the surface, it looks like you lived a pretty charmed life, a protected life. But there was some times in there of doubt, some times of anxiety, which you've shared with us. Living this just life of a movie, what do you think it's taught you?
Nondescript is good.
Well put.
For me, peace is good. Enjoying my coffee on the porch, not seeing a sedan across the street with two men sitting in it.
Yeah, I would say.
So inner peace. I saw my mom and dad, attorneys and court cases and money, and my father's name was never on anything. All these things that you don't think about that I assume all three of us do legally, right? If you want to buy something, you buy it. Doesn't matter. Check, whatever. My father never had a check, never, So how does that actually happen? It happens through, I'm going to use my father's word, maneuvering. And my father was a big gambler. So he didn't go to a Shylock. He wouldn't go to the street for money. He would go to a loan company. He would pay the guy off at Suburban on Center Street and Franklin Avenue in Nutley at the time.
It's very little consequences, especially he didn't own anything. If he defaults on the loan, who cares?
And just, give him his loans. But so what did I learn? I learned that honestly in life, wherever you find your peace, that's the life you have to lead. Peace. because that's probably the most important thing. And some people don't find peace for a long time. My father found his peace at 71 years old.
When he got out of the life, when he was already out of the life.
Yeah, he enjoyed for the first time getting up and making coffee, going out on his acre, tending to his tomato plants, with his terriers, going to the track. You know, he had peace. My father had ulcers. My father used to say, this is a monkey on my back. This is something you deal with every day.
Mm-hmm. I think your father was a duck on a pond. I've said this to you before, where you've told me some of his ailments during when he was in that lifestyle. Mm-hmm. He appeared calm on the surface, but mm-hmm. if you look underneath the water, those little legs are flapping a mile a minute.
Oh, yeah. He had GI issues, ulcers. Yeah, you're living with no protection from anyone.
Well, Angela, I can't thank you so enough to come in here and talk to two cops who I know you're not fond of and tell
you
this.
You think your father had ulcers then. Imagine what he's like now.
he's saying you're a traitor.
He's going, oh, Maron. The book is Welcome to the Family, My Life as a Mob Daughter. It is a wonderful book. I can't wait for this to be published. And you just got to promise me one thing. When it does get published, I would like a signed copy so we can keep it here in the studio.
And we'd like you back in the studio to promote the book.
That's another thing.
Oh, sure.
Well,
I'll come back. Thank you for having me. This was so
now that you've vetted us and you met us and everything else, it's okay. You'll come back to promote the book.
I had you all checked out.
Yeah. Well, we would trade, you know, I would read a little bit and I'd call her and we would trade critiques and stuff like this. I'm nobody, but, you know, it's nice to have another set of eyes.
You know, I have to say, though, when I left my house, there was a sedan across the street with these two guys sitting in it.
Yeah, but that was because of Andrew. That wasn't his. Thank you so much for coming.
Oh, thank you so much. It was fun.
And that's going to do it for this episode of the Suffering Podcast, the suffering of a mafia daughter. Yeah, mafia daughter, right? Okay. The suffering of a mafia daughter with Angela Pisano. And let's think about all the stuff that we learned today. Danger comes in many forms. Love hits when it wants to. In all business, you have to work your way up. Certain professions don't have a retirement plan. But most importantly, a father's love is a father's love.
And that's true.
And that's going to do it for this episode. Don't forget, you can join our subscription channel on YouTube. Follow us on all social media. That's LinkedIn, TikTok, Facebook, Instagram. Go to popple.com for a digital business card. Put in the code TSP20 for a 20% discount. Follow Mike at Mike_Fillets. Follow me at Real Kevin Donaldson. And of course, follow the Suffering Podcast. We'll see you on the next episode.